Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters Today. I'm Bob McChesney, your host here on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. As I said at the top of the hour, today we're going to be turning to this discussion of propaganda and the role it plays in our society. I remember growing up as a kid in Cleveland, Ohio in the 1950s and 60s, and learning about propaganda as something the bad guys did, the communists, that one of the things that was terrible about communism was that its leaders and its advocates invariably lied and lied consciously to advance their cause, thinking the ends justified the means. And it was one of the reasons why any free person would despise communism. And propaganda was their hallmark, and they proudly called it communist propaganda. Since then, as I've grown older and arguably somewhat wiser, I've learned that propaganda is not limited to the bad guys or any particular guys. It comes from many directions and many dimensions. And it's become an increasingly prominent part of life in the United States and worldwide. Today, it's probably as significant or as important as ever. And to help us understand contemporary propaganda, put it in historical context, I'm delighted to welcome to the show as our guest from California, a professor of global communications at Cal State University in Fullerton and an adjunct professor at the Annenberg School for Communications at the University of Southern California, Nancy Snow. Nancy Snow has written a couple of books. Her first book was called Propaganda Incorporated, and a second version of that will be coming out this coming month. And a new book, Information War, American Propaganda, Opinion Control, and Free Speech Since 9/11, is going to be published in the next few months, I think early next year. Nancy is joining us from her home in Los Angeles. Nancy, are you there?
Yes. Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing well, and I want to thank you very much for crawling out of the sack so early out on the West Coast to join us on the air here.
No problem. It's 11 a.m., so it's not too terribly early.
Well, I figure you have one of those West Coast lifestyles now that you're out there, Nancy.
That's right, they're where we sleep and go out late at night.
That's right, you know, hanging out with the movie stars and stuff. You know, why don't we start at the beginning? Because propaganda is a term that's used a lot, but, you know, I think it's got a lot of different meanings. It's usually used as sort of like if you're describing something you don't like, it's propaganda.
Absolutely,
if you agree with it, it's brilliant insight. How would you define propaganda? When did it arise? I mean, how should people think about it as a general concept?
Well, you know what? I often go right to the source. Actually, NATO has a definition in which it is the spreading of information and ideas in order to affect the attitudes, opinions, emotions of a targeted audience in order to really benefit the sender of the ideas. And I think it is absolutely true that we often want to dismiss whatever message or ideas is coming from our opponent is just a bunch of propaganda. And we have seen that over and over again since 9/11, that in the context of this war on terror, that the U.S. administration, particularly Bush, I've heard, and some others who are high up in the administration will say, well, bin Laden and his ilk engage in propaganda. We tell the truth. Most recently, it's come up again in the new international broadcasting efforts in the Middle East, notably Radio Sawa, Sawa meaning together, which is a new initiative, post-9/11 initiative, to, again, help to improve the image of the United States in the Middle East. I actually sat down with Norman Pattitz, who is the chairman of Westwood One in Los Angeles. This is my access to all of these people is greater than it ever was when I was living in New Hampshire. And I sat down with him and asked him about the purpose of Radio Sawa, and he said, well, it's to overcome the hate media in the Middle East and to, again, enhance the image. And I said, would you call it propaganda? And he said, absolutely not. We don't engage in propaganda. He was just this week in the L.A. Times quoted again as saying just that. And the L.A. Times article from Wednesday, August 21st, said that Radio Sawa, which has been around for a few months, is being criticized by the listeners. They liked the music. They liked the programming because there was a lot of research and focus grouping that went into the audience to see what kind of music they would like, both international and indigenous-style music. But what they didn't like was the editorializing, and they said, we don't like the U.S. government propagandizing. And I think there, again, my purpose in my research and in my speaking is to really get us to understand that virtually all governments engage in a form of propaganda, and to demystify this concept, not to fear it so much. It has become such a negative concept because in the post-Cold War era, we associated it naturally with totalitarian systems of government. But whether you're a democracy or a totalitarian system, governments like to present their message and their ideas in a favorable light. So it's not just a pack of lies, which is, again, sort of the myth that it's come to represent. And also, furthermore, I would invite people to take a look at a classic text on propaganda by the French writer Jacques Ellul, which came out in 1965. I remember reading this in graduate school. And in the first, in the introduction, he refers to three propaganda blocks in the modern era: the United States, the Soviet Union, and China. And now, again, with the demise of the Soviet Union, I suppose that leaves us with two major propaganda blocks. But it's tough in the U.S. environment to get people to acknowledge that this is what we do, and that the world tends to view the United States as probably the having the most expertise in this area. Often propaganda is used interchangeably with advertising and marketing and public relations. And my new colleagues at Cal State Fullerton, where public relations is a very popular major and a very solid program, we have an ongoing dialogue about that. Is it, you know, are there aspects of propaganda to PR? And I would say there are. But again, in this context, to look at propaganda in a more neutral, as a more neutral concept, and then to begin to analyze what are the intentions, what are the outcomes of this propaganda.
The role it plays in our society and has played, and especially we want to talk about what's taken place in the past year since 9/11 on the propaganda wars, the information wars. If you'd like to call in and ask Nancy Snow a question, the number here at Media Matters is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. Nancy, let's back up for a second. You've already backed up to 1965. Let's push it back a couple more generations and talk about when propaganda sort of became a major and significant force in international politics. Some background for our listeners, please.
I would say probably in the early 20th century. When I go back, I go back in U.S. history, and I generally begin with the Creel Committee in the Wilson administration. Of course, Wilson was reelected on the under the banner of "He kept us out of the war."
This was in 1916,
right? 1916, and at the time in which the administration shifted its position and decided it was going to get involved in the war effort, it had a population, an American population, that was decidedly either neutral or pacifistic. There were a number of peace groups that were very active at that time, and there, of course, the Communist Party was much more of a part of the American political system.
I don't think the Communists existed quite then, but the Socialist Party, I think you're referring to.
The Socialist Party was certainly active then, and of course there was a lot more party participation and movement type activity. And so the administration under Wilson met with George Creel, who was an American journalist and had worked also in advertising. He had sort of almost a parallel background and biography to our current Charlotte Bierce, but that's another story. And Creel formed the Creel Committee, or the Committee on Public Information, CPI, with this very generic name of, and it actually was the, in terms of multimedia and multitasking, it was quite incredible. It had a film committee, it had a pamphlet committee, it had a broadcasting committee. Again, media was quite different then, but it was about the most sophisticated type propaganda operation of that day. It included a group of, I guess you could say, leaders in their communities, referred to as the four-minute men, and they were all men, and they gave these persuasive appeals in the movie houses. They actually had to go through a background check, so to speak, and have neighbors and friends write letters of recommendation in order to become part of this network, and it was to go out and really to sell the war to the American people. And there's a great book that George Creel wrote about the experience of heading the committee, and it's called How We Advertised America. And it was, I think the subtitle is one of the longest. It goes on, he says, how we were able to spread the zeal for American capitalism to every corner of the globe, something along those lines.
Now, as I understand it, Nancy, for those who weren't sufficiently influenced or convinced by George Creel and his committee that this war was a good thing, there was also the stick of government repression, was there not?
Right, right, indeed. And I... that is always part and parcel of it, whether it's in the form of self-censorship or at the time there were certainly government acts in place, the Alien Acts and Sedition that were really designed to suppress free speech. And so by design, it was to get everyone on the bandwagon, literally being a propaganda term to refer to sort of one mindset that if you're not on the bandwagon with us, then you're thinking wrong and you're un-American. And I think CPI is really an important time in our history to look back upon and to compare it to where we are now, because I've certainly heard a lot of people talk about in the last year this sense of not feeling comfortable to really share their criticisms of what's going on, whether it's in the form of this new Office of Strategic Influence, short-lived as it was back in February, or other committees that have come in place. Most recently in July, the administration announced the Office of Global Communications, which created quite a ripple in the foreign affairs community, which would be coming out of the Bush administration and to sort of promote again a favorable image of the United States. There are people inside the State Department, many who thought, isn't that what we're already doing? So but I think CPI is one to look back upon because it shows that we have a 100-year history in place of this marketing campaign to benefit U.S. government objectives and to also to promote American capitalist interests overseas. And that was really kind of the crux of my first book, Propaganda, Inc., was how this kind of promoting of the United States generally is often commingled with making the world safe for American corporate interests.
You know, Nancy, as I listened to you, I know at the beginning you said that we need to have sort of a dispassionate view of propaganda,
right,
and try to take it on its own, understand it as it is and not prejudge it.
Right.
But when I hear you discuss the Committee on Public Information and knowing the history of that period, it's hard not to say, well, gosh, this really doesn't sound like something that's very good for a free society to
right.
have organized right. campaigns to basically try to shape the way people think.
Sure. Well, and I, on the one hand, I want people to, I think when you're talking about propaganda, it's just very quick, Bob, for people to get very riled up and to just start saying, well, let's not go there. And so I've sort of intentionally said often when I talk about this that let's look at it as it is, and then let's take a step further and decide whether or not that's good for a free and open society. Right now, though, I'm trying, and I've made some progress in my work to get people to accept that it is part of the American way of life. That is the sort of the shading and manipulation of information, and that it's important that we understand that. And I think for many Americans, that is a problem in itself because it's much easier to dismiss propaganda to associate it with closed societies. One of the in the introduction of Alul's book in Propaganda, he said it's harder for people in an open society, in a free society, to accept that their society would engage in this form of information control manipulation because it's not as readily available. It's one thing if you are living in a communist society where you've got the big billboards and the slogans everywhere and the picture of the chairman in place, and it's pretty clear and obvious that there is information control there and no free press. And so people just come to accept that, well, yes, we are being propagandized and we can kind of, you know, we have to sort of go along with the program in order to survive the system. But in the American context, because practically on a daily basis, whether it's in the newspaper or on radio or television, we hear We're a free society. We're about free speech. We promote diversity, tolerance for a wide range of opinions. If you hear that steady drumbeat over and over again, it's harder then rationally for people to accept, well, where is then this information control taking place? It's just very, very difficult to reconcile those two, that you have a free society. And I would argue, as I do in my book, that in Propaganda Inc., that the promotion of these ideas of free society and diversity and even democracy have become really part of that way of controlling free speech, because they sort of become what we often refer to as glittering generalities. Democracy just sounds good. It's a touchy-feely term. But what does it really mean in practice? And I think that we often bounce it around, and different leaders will bounce it around because it sounds good. It's what we represent to ourselves and not always to the rest of the world. And so it doesn't really, by design, lead to that critical thinking that we need when we're discussing and analyzing propaganda and information control. So, are we living in a totalitarian, you know, style of government? Absolutely not, not even close. But in a free society, we need to look at some of the traits of that information control. And it's often really hidden from view. You have to dig a little deeper here. You have to ask more critical questions.
And that's what we're going to do on today's show.
Okay.
My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here on WILL AM 580. Our guest, Professor Nancy Snow, talking to us from the West Coast, who's written two books now on propaganda and the information wars, and is an expert on recent developments in government information campaigns. If you'd like to call in and ask Professor Snow a question, the number is 333-9455 or our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. We have a couple open lines. Let's go to the phone lines right now, Nancy.
Okay.
Champagne, you're on the air with Nancy Snow.
Yeah, thank you. Sometimes I question just how free a society we really have. I mean, I believe that the current Bush regime carried out a coup back in the elections and didn't really win the election in Florida. But that aside, you know, I find it interesting that the New York Times is under attack now for being accused of carrying out an anti-war campaign in their front page, while it seems to me, when I watch and, you know, listen to and read a lot of other media, they seem to be doing the exact opposite. And certainly if you look at, you know, Murdoch's media empire, they seem to very much be beating the drum for war, you know. And so it's like when you have this one major source that seems critical or at least questioning the legitimacy or, you know, rightness of carrying out a preemptive war against another nation, they're attacked. While at the same time, it seems like there's so much, you know, in the, you know, being carried out on the other side where they're really pushing it.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know as far as the New York Times. I'm not as familiar with this campaign. I guess it's most recent. I think it's...
Yeah, I'll give you a little background on it, Nancy. What's happened is over the past 4 to 6 weeks, a number of times the New York Times has leaked reports from insiders in the Pentagon or State Department critical of a prospective invasion of Iraq. And proponents of such an invasion of Iraq are accusing the New York Times then of fomenting anti-war opinion.
Right. Well, I do know that the Washington Post recently is under the gun for the same thing, that they are also releasing information that's very sensitive. And I think this is there's a whole history of newspapers being accused of not being in alignment with the administration's position. The administration often has the advantage because they can mask it in the cloak of national security, that for national security reasons we cannot have this information get out there. Lives are at stake. For the most part, I've heard, at least in the School of Journalism over at the Annenberg School, a number of journalists say that they're not aware of any case in which lives were really at stake as a result of information that was released. In fact, working reporters, whether it's in this case the New York Times or the Washington Post, or any responsible reporter, They will hold off on information. They will embargo it and make sure that there aren't any lives at stake, and that we really don't have any case that the government will often say that people are going to die as a result of this information getting out here.
Well, I think this criticism wasn't even that about that sort of issue, that this sort of hurt our troops or anything, but rather it was simply that it would undermine support for a war in Iraq that the administration, some elements of the administration, are eager to pursue. How about that? I mean, have we had a propaganda campaign over Iraq? Does this qualify the sort of public debate and the push by the administration to encourage some sort of action in Iraq? Was that propagandistic?
Well, I would think if that's the crux of the argument, that somehow the front page of these leading newspapers of record are fomenting an anti-war movement, I don't see how that couldn't be part of a propaganda campaign, because it raises the question of what is the role of the press in a free society. Is it the role of the press to go along with the administration's position vis-a-vis Iraq, or is it the role of the press to raise the critical questions that are not being generated by this administration? I know that we're about to get to that period of the one-year anniversary of 9/11, and I've been contacted by reporters to sort of weigh in on where are we now as a nation. And I've often fallen to this position of, where is the public outcry on Iraq? I mean, I would really invite any kind of an anti-war movement, if that's really the feeling of the American people, get out there and make your voices heard. And it's responsible pressmanship of the New York Times to actually document this, that there are other sides to the equation here, and that there is criticism from across the political spectrum, that the last thing you want is sort of a one president with a few officials there deciding on behalf of the country to go ahead with a very serious campaign where, again, lives could be affected, soldiers from the United States going, but also civilians inside Iraq.
Nancy, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it, it strikes me, the way you described the rise of government propaganda in World War One, where the government was faced with trying to mobilize a population to support a war it really wasn't that interested in supporting. It had to be convinced that it should support the
right.
war by the government.
Right.
That strikes me as being awfully similar to what's taking place right now with Iraq, where there isn't really a groundswell of support for the United States to send lots of troops and spend billions of dollars to take over this country and sort of manage it for a while. And those in the government who want to do so are really engaged in a propaganda war to try to make that seem like something that we should do.
Well, it certainly has characteristics of that. I heard President Bush, or at least it was reported last week, that when he decides that we're going to go ahead, we, our nation, our country, he is going to go before the American people. It'll probably be one of these primetime addresses to explain why the administration has decided to invade Iraq. And I was really struck by that, because I thought, well, where again is the public accountability here, which we are asked as the American people, most recently in this Operation TIPS program, to sort of those of us who work, say, for state and local government or postal carriers, to sort of keep our eyes open and to play our part in this war on terrorism and report suspicious activity to the government. If we're being asked to do that, to do our part as American citizens, then the administration has to give us the same respect to have some dialogue and discussion before Bush comes forward and has sort of like a an announcement that we're going forward. I think that it really troubled me to hear that he's just going to announce to the American people as if the decision has already been made. And I think for many Americans, we often feel like we're not experts on Iraq. We may not be experts on that region of the world, but by the same token, we would like a weighing of options presented to us. And I think the concern there is this going to be just a PR or a propaganda campaign to say, this is what we're doing, case closed. And that's why I do think that there are parallels with the Committee on Public Information, that they had to really explicitly go out and just build up sort of rah-rah support for engaging in war making, and they turned this population around and made people really almost foaming at the mouth in some cases in their support for war. And I don't know when that will take place here. I think there's a great deal of concern and hesitation on the part of the American people, but there's no channel in which they can weigh in on this because we have a media system in place in which we are often just passive observers and members of the audience, and we sort of tune in and get the latest, but there's no feedback loop in which we can say, now, wait a minute, let's stop and go slow here because you're doing this in my name as an American citizen.
We're talking to Nancy Snow today on Media Matters. She's our guest talking about propaganda, especially government propaganda in terms of international politics and events since 9/11. The number here at WILL, if you want to talk to Nancy on Media Matters, is 333-9455 or the toll-free number 800-222-9455. One other thing that caller discussed sort of in his introduction to his question was the 2000 presidential election that President George W. Bush eventually, I guess, won in a way, certainly won the Supreme Court decision.
Mm-hmm.
As a propaganda analyst, is there a propaganda analysis that goes in of how that election took place?
Well, I mean, we often say that propaganda begins where critical thinking ends, or and I think what was going on in Florida became sort of a movie of a week that went on for several weeks, and there were characters involved. Propaganda often has very flavorful personalities involved, and so you have one side giving its point of view, its slant on things, and the other side, you had James Baker versus... who was the former Secretary of State,
Daley.
Clinton.
Warren Christopher.
Yeah, Warren Christopher. So they would sort of have this almost like tennis match. And there again, I think the public role was really reduced to sort of just these crowds of people with banners. Often what we see on television is very orchestrated. For instance, in the Enron case, when we saw the images of former Enron employees, there was one that was a very prominent sort of a march or a rally in front of some of the offices in Washington, and it was shown on all the national media. And it turned out that was handled, whether it was Hill and Knowlton, it was by one of the national PR firms that handled that and handed out the placards and, you know, had everybody sort of looking kind of like they were sort of dressed down to look like just regular everyday folks. But these are often very orchestrated campaigns, and I think that what happened in Florida was, again, very orchestrated, sort of made for TV, and a real sense and understanding of what was going on was not there. I think it became just like background noise or just noise that we wanted to turn off. And so the Bush administration really had a certain advantage there in that they presented their case as the American people want to move forward. I remember that was
so. Really, I mean, in a situation like that, shouldn't it's good that if Bush did better propaganda, doesn't he deserve to be president then?
Right.
If so much of the job of government is to propagandize, don't you want the best propaganda team running the government?
Well, actually, I don't think that the proper role of government is to propagandize. I say that it is part of what all governments do. But in terms of what we want in a president, that varies. I think the kind of president we have, we do have one who's certainly effective in simplifying matters, and sometimes in explaining things in which there's really not a whole lot to go on. And that can be very much successful in a propaganda campaign, that you engage in simple slogans that get people riled up and on board. But if they were really to step back and kind of think and scratch their heads, they might say, what was that was just presented to me, or what was that was just said to me?
Well, we've got a couple.
We don't have a lot of that kind of analysis going on, or at least we don't have enough of it. And I think it really comes back to having some avenues in which that kind of critical analysis can take place. I don't know about you, Bob, but as an academic and as a college professor, I was very troubled by some of the reports coming out last fall. There were some groups that got started, Americans for Victory over Terrorism. There was the group in Washington that released a report that said that academics on college campuses that, you know, like the New York Times, that we were promoting this sort of anti-Americanism, and particularly in the social sciences, because we were causing our students to question the administration. And I thought to myself, well, what is my function? What is my role as a scholar, as a professor who meets regularly with students? Is it just to promote the acceptable, the conventional wisdom on things, or is it to get them to think for themselves? And that's why I think it's important to look at propaganda and analyze it, because the goal is to get you ultimately to think for yourself, so that propaganda will really lose some of its saliency, that we will be able to, as individuals, look at information and become more critical consumers of information.
On that note, Nancy, let's go back to our phone lines. We have three people who have been very patient and been waiting, and I'd like to go to them now if we can. Eureka, you're on the air with Nancy Snow.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate her explanations, and I guess I just have a comment, but it just seems to me that we are near some of the darkest periods that I can remember, maybe Nixon during 72, 73, near the end of the Vietnam War and the bombing of Haiphong and Hanoi, or maybe during the darkest hours of the Gulf War in terms of the government's attitudes, because I think you perfectly articulated the mission of a good professor to get people to think, and I think people who are responsible, who seem to be asking highly legitimate questions, it's not said exactly, but it almost seems like the attitude of the administration is you're treasonous. Because you're questioning our so-called specialized knowledge, and you know, just trust us because we're going to do the best for our country. And you're talking about a war and all kinds of madness.
Mm. Thank you. I appreciate your comments.
Now, Nancy, let me add something onto that comment. I mean, one of the defenses of the use of propaganda by, say, the U.S. government or politicians here as opposed to the Nazis or the communists or something like that, is that those governments, you know, had political monopoly on a monopoly on political power, and our government is elected. So if these people propagandize us outrageously, we can throw them out of office in the next election. So we shouldn't really have to worry too much about it. What do you make of that argument?
Well, I guess I worry a little bit more than just in having biannual elections, or I don't put a lot of faith and sort of throw the rascals out, because I think that we have a system in place which perpetuates this kind of information control. It's really ironic in that we live in this, we keep saying, an information society, and there's no other time that I know of in which we have been in a position to sort of be smart about everything, because the information is there. And so most of us, we have a constant sort of need to inform ourselves. But at the same time, we live in this system, in this environment, in this media environment, in which we get a lot of information in the service of misinformation and ignorance. It's a lot of sort of an overflow of information that is often decontextualized. It goes from Britney Spears' latest song to now the weather, to, gee, what's next with Iraq, and to try to keep a pace of it, I can't. I sort of feel really disjointed at the end of most of the programs that I either watch or listen to, and I think it really puts a burden on the individual consumer of information to try to make sense, to put this in context. So as much as I always have faith in the democratic system in terms of free elections, and yes, there isn't this political monopoly, my worry is that we have to have a media system that really promotes that same system of accountability. And again, that's where I go back to the media airwaves and broadcasters having an understanding of this being really a public trust, and promoting the public interest, that they need to take that very seriously. And I often think that there is this firewall of protection in which the public is something out there that you then feed to advertisers and we're sort of in this reduced role as members of the public. So I guess you could say that there's a lot more work to be done because we don't really have that system in place to promote being a well-informed public that can make the right choices when it comes to campaigns.
We're talking to Nancy Snow today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We have a couple callers waiting patiently we'll get to. If you'd like to join them, we have a couple lines open. The number is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. And let me take a second right now to tell you who's going to be on the show the next 2 weeks. A week from today, we're going to have as our guest Barbara Ehrenreich, the well-known journalist who's written a bestseller book, Nickel and Dimed. She'll be joining us to talk about her reflections on media and politics. 2 weeks from today, our guest will be Susan Douglas, a media commentator and writer, a professor at the University of Michigan, who's done a lot of work on the history of radio, the nature of radio, and the portrayal of women in our media. So next week and the following week, Ehrenreich and Douglas, please join us. And let's go back to the phone lines now and see who we've got there. Champagne, you're on the air with Nancy Snow.
Yes. I think it's kind of interesting that Nancy said that she thought the information was out there, because I think that it's very difficult to get the information that we need to be an educated electorate. And I think it's Noam Chomsky has referred to our country as a democratic fascist state at the moment, because it's aristocrats, really, or plutocrats or oligarchs that are running the show, and there's only two parties out there that are going to get power, and there's not enough information for the common person to make a reasonable decision, choice on most matters, and you don't really have a choice on most matters because you have two parties that are so similar that you can't get things done. So I think that Jefferson would, if he were alive today, would be advocating that we splinter into smaller, more manageable governmental entities where you could have enough information to process. It seems like the further you get away from the school board on up to the federal level, the less information you have, the less informed decisions you make, the more you rely on your biases, and the more you rely on propaganda.
All right. Thank you, caller. Nancy, what do you think? Is it somewhat an issue of size then? I mean, is it just the magnitude of the size of our country combined with the media blizzards makes the ability to actually cut through the propaganda and have effective self-government impossible?
Sure. And we don't have the training, Bob. I mean, that was a point well taken, because he started out by saying, it's interesting I say that the information is out there. And I guess, in a way, I didn't mean to imply that, the fault is your own if you don't get that information. What I was trying to say is that, we're told that this is the information age. It's driven by information technology, that we're all online 24/7, that the media soundbite is getting shorter and shorter, and that we really, there's no excuse, or at least that seems to be what the implicit message is to having access to information. And we see this happening now in a legal context too, that people are being told that, we don't need these warning labels and such because the information is out there for everybody to have. But I think that we're not trained in an education to really look at information literacy, to really give people a sense of how do you go out and really conduct research in this area. I often say, when it comes to propaganda, I'm not part of that school. I don't have a background in working for the intelligence agencies, the CIA, the FBI, where I had access to information that was top secret and that wasn't available to the public. Everything that I write about is open sourced, and so I will tell people that I'm not doing anything differently than anybody else. I'm interested in the information that's there that perhaps hasn't been sort of tied together the way that I tie it together. But it is so difficult, and Bob, it's easier for us as academics. We're part of a privileged community. We get a lot more access to databases that just members of the public don't have. And so I'm quite spoiled in that arena, and I think it's just difficult for most people to know how to go about gleaning that information because we're not trained to do it. And I think that that is in itself by design. I'm not talking a conspiracy theory, but by that I mean that a truly well-informed public, a truly participatory public, is a rather dangerous prospect for those who wish to control information, for those who wish to promote one point of view and who do not invite critical comment.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Line 2, Champaign, you're on the air with Nancy Snow.
Hi. I was hoping maybe you could speak a little about what happened in Nicaragua under, I believe it was the previous Bush administration's time, and what our given cause was.
Could you be a little more specific, caller? I'm a little confused. You mean with the Sandinistas losing the election in 1990, or the U.S. policy throughout the 1980s towards Nicaragua?
I'm not exactly sure what happened. That's why I was calling. Perhaps the professor could elaborate.
Well, I can say this much, and just talk about Nicaragua in the context of being an activist. In the 1980s, when I was in college, there were quite a number of peace movements directed toward Central America, particularly under Reagan and Bush. The feeling was, there again, I think there's a context for our conversation, that the public, the American people, were in the dark as far as what was really going on, what were the intentions of our government in Central America. And, of course, there again, it was in a Cold War context. It may seem like ancient history, but most of my formal education was looking at the U.S.-Soviet Union struggle, and so many of these countries, poor countries like Nicaragua, were really just the sort of proving ground for which country was going to dominate. And so the Sandinistas were referred to as the as tied to the communist government and as really, again, our enemies, the way bin Laden is portrayed now. And then the soldiers that the U.S. government was backing then were referred to by Reagan, I remember, as freedom fighters. And so you will often hear freedom and democracy used interchangeably. Whatever those guys are up to, they're fighting for our freedom. And I think that that was a problem for the American people to really have an understanding of the history of why so many of the Nicaraguan people were against the having the Contras there, who were fighting against the government in place. It was just very hard to sort of get a handle on, and so the administration was trying to paint it as good versus evil, as freedom versus totalitarianism. And there again, most people will sort of take that kind of hook, line, and sinker because they don't know really what else to do. We want to believe that our government is telling us the truth, that is really forthcoming. We want to believe that that's true in a democracy and in our system of government. And so we don't often then go further and ask those questions. Plus, we're not rewarded for asking questions of history and context. If anything, we're pigeonholed as not being truly American. I wanted to add that so much of my work really is driven by my my love of some mentors, including Fulbright, and I often will quote him from his book, The Arrogance of Power.
We have some young listeners who might not be familiar with who Fulbright is.
J. William Fulbright. He was actually the visionary behind the Fulbright program, and he was a senator from Arkansas. His name came into the news a lot when Clinton was first elected because President Bill Clinton, his first job was actually working under the senator, and Senator Fulbright was also the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee during the Vietnam War, and he became vilified for his very open criticism and his critical engagement of what exactly the United States, our role and our function and our goal was in Vietnam.
You know, Nancy, we've only got about 7 or 8 minutes left, and we've got a couple callers, so I think maybe we should get back to the phone lines.
All right.
Urbana, you're on the air with Nancy Snow.
Hello. Yes, I'd like to get back to your question earlier that there was a difference between propaganda in a democracy and propaganda in a totalitarian state. And it seems to me that we only have to go back to the last election, in which a combination of electoral fraud at the local level, extreme disinformation from one candidate in particular, and a packed Supreme Court subverted the democratic principle.
Mm.
So that I don't see that it is less dangerous in a democracy. I think it's more dangerous because it can destroy the democracy if unchecked.
You know, that's an interesting point. The caller raises an issue that has been made by other observers, which is that propaganda is more dangerous in a democracy because you have your guard down. I mean, someone living in the Soviet Union, when they picked up Pravda, understood that it was propaganda. They knew, you know, to be skeptical and wary.
Absolutely.
Whereas in our society, that skepticism isn't there as much because you're told, you know, you're led to believe this is a free society, so you can trust what you're told, or at least trust it more than you would if you lived in Nazi Germany or Soviet Russia.
No, that's exactly true. It's often characterized, propaganda in the democracy, as like a fish in water. The fish isn't aware of the water. It's the surround sound of its existence. And I think that may be the way that we need to begin to look at our society here. It does make it perhaps more insidious. It certainly makes it less visible to us. And it makes your work as a critical analyst that much harder because, again, I go back to my earlier comment that I don't think that we really truly have critical thinking going on, whether it's in our schools or in the university, not to a large extent because you're not really rewarded. We're rewarded in a system to give the information that people need in order to fit well into the system, in order to be productive members of our society. And I was struck when I was in graduate school and I was only working part-time, and this was, of course, in Washington, D.C., but people would ask me, what do you do? And I'd say, well, I'm working on my doctorate. And they'd say, but do you have a job? And I always laugh about that with some of my younger students, that in the American system, you're really not a full-fledged member of society until you're out there doing something and doing some kind of job. And sometimes the kinds of jobs people do, they're not really inviting that critical commentary. And so there again, I think it can be more dangerous, certainly, in that, yes, when you pick up Pravda, which means truth, you can sort of scowl at it and laugh about it behind closed doors. But here, we believe that when we're picking up our newspaper, that we're really engaging, in a free flow of information, or when we're listening to our government leaders talk to us.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines if we can. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Nancy Snow.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
Yes, I just had a question. I have heard a lot about this war on terrorism, and perhaps that's part of the reason the Bush administration is thinking that they could invade Iraq. I'm wondering, is that possibly just a propaganda model they're using when in fact this might be a war concerning the control of oil?
Well, when you're looking at what you name things, it's really important that when you do this kind of analysis, you look at first how do you name things, especially from the start. And 9/11, within a few hours, the U.S. response was a war. And within a day or so, it was a war on terrorism, and it became a global effort. And I think when you pull out all the stops, I heard Howard Zinn speak in April, and he said, we often name things a war when we don't know what else to do. And it also serves a function in that it cuts off the dialogue. Once you go to war, that means you've got your walking papers. It's time to go and conscript your soldiers, and the public should just fall into line.
So, yeah, conscript its brain.
Yeah, and conscript its brain. And so when you have a global war on terrorism, then really everything is on the table again. And so whether or not that was calculated, I mean, it was no surprise to revisit Iraq. I think for many of us, the feeling was once Bush was elected that that was going to be on the table. But certainly in the context of a war on terrorism, it really does raise the ante, and it in my sense, it really does cut off that dialogue and cut off the public role. And it's really incumbent upon all of us then to not allow that role to be cut off, because we've got to hold these institutions accountable, whether it's media or government, and go back to our own history, pick up the U.S. Constitution and bring your documentation and show that, you know, this is really what our history is all about, because if they're going to use slogans against us, we can use some of the same back to them.
Well, is the solution then, Nancy, that those who are opposed to one propaganda campaign by the government or some other self-interested party need to simply fire back with their own propaganda?
Well, I do think that there is value in really studying what kind of techniques that they use and to mirror those techniques back to them in some way. I know that I've done some work recently with the globalization activists and in sort of framing their language differently. And I know that there is some debate about this. You know, why use those same techniques back?
I mean, I would think a concern would be, we don't have much time, that just if you can get to this, is that if the other side or other sides do the exact same techniques, then the person sort of in the middle, caught in the crossfire, is going to sort of write everyone off equally as just, you know, a BS artist.
Well, yeah, I would hope that some of the techniques, you wouldn't go too far, that people are going to just tune it out. But I guess what I'm saying is that it's really important to understand the techniques and to know how to use them if you're engaging with the opponent, and that's the only way that they'll engage with you. But, I mean, that's open for discussion. We can, you know, it's not part and parcel, but I do think that that could be perhaps on the table. And ultimately, though, I would want to get to the point where we're really we're beyond these propaganda techniques, because they are about the simplification of language. They are about the simplification of technique. But I'm not sure that we're there yet, because we're in such an environment in which this is, again, how we grow up. We're born into this environment of propaganda. I don't know how you rise above it until you at least get to a point where people understand what it's all about.
Nancy, I hear the band tuning up, which means it's time for me to clear out of the studio.
Okay.
I'd like to thank Nancy Snow for being our guest today on Media Matters. And we'll get you back on the air when your next book gets out, Nancy.
Great. Thanks so much.
And my name is Bob McChesney here at Media Matters. I'll be back next week with Barbara Ehrenreich and the following week with Susan Douglas. I'd like to thank Ben Byrne for producing today's show and Dak for working the board. See you next week.